but just able to inflict a surfeit of civilian agony. Denial of enforcement. Enforcement of promises is also relevant to the influence of a third party that wishes to make an efficient outcome more difficult for the other two players. A potent means of banning illegal activities has often been the outlawing of them so that contracts become unenforceable. Failure to enforce gambling contracts or contracts in restraint of trade or contracts for the delivery of liquor during prohibition has always been part of the process of discouraging the activities themselves. Sometimes, of course, prohibition of this sort delivers enormous power into the hands of anyone who can enforce contracts or make enforceable promises. The denial of copyright liquor labels during prohibition meant that only the bigger gangs could guarantee the quality of their liquor, and hence assisted them in developing monopoly control of the business. By the same token, laws to protect brands and labels can perhaps be viewed as devices that facilitate business based on unwritten contracts. Relinquishing the initiative. What makes the threat or ordinary commitment a difficult tactic to employ and an interesting one to study is the problem of finding a means to commitment, the available penalty to invoke against one's own non-performance. There is, consequently, a related set of tactics that consists of maneuvering oneself into a position in which one no longer has any effective choice over how he shall behave or respond. The purpose of these tactics is to get rid of an embarrassing initiative, making the outcome depend solely on the other party's choice. This is the kind of tactic that Secretary of State John Foster Dulles was looking for in the following passage. In the future, it may thus be feasible to place less reliance upon deterrence of vast retaliatory power. Thus, in contrast to the 1950 decade, it may be that by the 1960 decade, the nations which are around the Sino-Soviet perimeter can possess an effective defense against full-scale conventional attack, and thus confront any aggressor with the choice between failing or himself initiating nuclear war against the defending country. Thus, the tables may be turned in the sense that instead of those who are non-aggressive having to rely upon all-out nuclear retaliatory power for their protection, would-be aggressors would be unable to count on a successful conventional aggression, but must themselves weigh the consequence of invoking nuclear war. The distinction between the type of deterrence he imputes to the 1950s and the type he imputes to the 1960s differs in the matter of who has to make that final decision. And the difference is important because the United States cannot find or bring itself to trust a persuasive means of commitment to the threat of massive retaliation against certain types of aggression. There was a time shortly after the first atomic bomb was exploded when there was some journalistic speculation about whether the Earth's atmosphere had a limited tolerance to nuclear fission. The idea was bruited about that a mighty chain reaction might destroy the Earth's atmosphere when some critical number of bombs had already been exploded. Someone proposed that if this were true and if we could calculate with accuracy that critical level of tolerance, we might neutralize atomic weapons for all time by a deliberate program of openly and dramatically exploding N-1 bombs. This tactic of shifting responsibility to the other player was nicely accomplished by Lieutenant Colonel, then Major, Stevenson B. Canyon, USAF, in using his aircraft to protect a Chinese nationalist surface vessel about to be captured by communist surface forces in his comic strip. Unwilling and unauthorized to initiate hostilities and knowing that no threat to do so would be credited, he directed his planes to jettison gasoline in a burning ring about the aggressor forces, leaving to them the last clear chance of reversing their engines to avoid the flames. He could neither drop gasoline on the enemy ships nor threaten to, so he dropped the initiative instead. The same tactic is involved in those dramatic forms of passive resistance that might be better called active non-resistance. According to the New York Times, striking railway workers sat down on the tracks at more than 300 stations in Japan today, halting 48 passenger and 144 freight trains. A more dramatic instance, also Japanese, was reported in the same paper. A public debate is being held here this week on whether to send a suicide sit-down fleet to the forbidden waters around Christmas Island, the site of the forthcoming British hydrogen bomb experiment. The first object of the expedition would be to prevent the British blast. Identification. An important characteristic of any game is how much each side knows about the other's value system. But a similar information problem arises with respect to sheer identification. The bank employee who would like to rob the bank if he could only find an outside collaborator, and the bank robber who would like to rob the bank if only he could find an inside accomplice, may find it difficult to collaborate because they are unable to identify each other, there being severe penalties in the event that either should declare his intentions to someone who proved not to have identical interests. The boy who is afraid to ask a girl for a date because she might rebuff him is in a similar position. Similarly, the kidnapper cannot operate properly if he cannot tell the rich from the poor in advance. And the anti-segregation minority in the South may never know whether it is large or small because of the penalties on declaration. Identification, like communication, is not necessarily reciprocal, and the act of self-identification may sometimes be reversible and sometimes not. One may achieve more identification than he bargained for once he declares his interest in an object. A nice example occurs in Shakespeare's Measure for Measure. Angelo, acting in place of the Duke, has a prisoner whom he proposes to kill. He could torture him, but he has no incentive to. The victim has a sister, who arrives to plead for his life. Angelo, finding the sister attractive, proposes a dishonorable bargain. The sister declines. Angelo then threatens to torture the brother unless the sister submits. At this point, the game has been expanded simply by the establishment of identity and a line of communication. Angelo's only interest in torturing the brother is in what he may gain by making a threat to do so. Once there is somebody available to whom the threat can profitably be communicated, the possibility of torture has value for Angelo. Not the torture itself, but the threatening of it. The sister has gotten negative value out of her trip. Having identified her interest and made herself available to receive the threatening message, she has been forced to suffer what she would not have had to suffer if she had never made her identity known, or if she could have disappeared into the crowd before the threat was made. A nice identification game was uncovered in a New York suburb a few years ago. Certain motorists carried identity cards, which identified them to policemen as members in a club. If the motorist with a membership card was arrested, he simply showed the card to the policeman and paid a bribe. The role of these cards was to identify the motorist as a person who, if the bribe was received, would keep quiet. It identified the motorist as a man whose promise was enforceable. But the card identifies the motorist only after he has been arrested. If the police could identify card-carrying motorists by looking at them, they could concentrate their arrests on card-carrying drivers, threatening a ticket unless payment were received. The card is contingent identification at the option of the motorist. A similar situation, pertinent to the discussion of promises as well as to identification, is described by Sutherland. Most coppers are more or less fair in their dealings with thieves simply because it pays them to be so. They will extend favors even after a pinch which they would not extend to non-professionals whom they lock up. They realize that it is safe to do this and that high officials will not be informed, as might be the case if favors were extended to amateurs. Identification is also relevant to an important economic fact that tends to be ignored in the conventional economics of production and exchange, namely the enormous potential for destruction that is available and that is relevant because of the extortionate threats that could be supported by it. The ordinary healthy high school graduate of slightly below average intelligence has to work fairly hard to produce more than $3,000 or $4,000 of value per year. But he could destroy 100 times that much if he set his mind to it, according to the writer's hasty calculations. Given an institutional arrangement in which he could generously abstain from destruction in return for a mere fraction of the value that he might have destroyed, the boy clearly has a calling as an extortionist rather than as a mechanic or clerk. It is fortunate that extortion usually depends on self-identification and overt communication by the extortionist himself. The importance of self-identification is attested by the significance attached to the doctrine that an accused person should be permitted to know and to confront his accuser. It is also reflected in secret testimony before a grand jury in cases where identifiable witnesses might be intimidated by potential defendants, and in efforts to keep secret the identity of eyewitnesses to a crime until the criminal is apprehended. The strategy of law and of law enforcement and criminal deterrence is a rich field for the application of game theory. Delegation. Another move that is sometimes available is the delegation of part or all of one's interest or part or all of one's initiative for decision to some agent who becomes, or perhaps already is, another player in the game. Insurance schemes permit the sharing of interests. The insurance company has a different incentive structure from the insured party and may be better able to make threats or resist them for that reason. Requiring several signatures on a check accomplishes a similar purpose. The use of a professional collecting agency by a business firm for the collection of debts is a means of achieving unilateral rather than bilateral communication with its debtors, and of being therefore unavailable to hear pleas or threats from the debtors. Providing ammunition to South Korean troops or giving them access to prisoner of war camps so that they can unilaterally release prisoners is a tactical means of relinquishing an embarrassing power of decision. Embarrassing because it subjects one to coercive or deterrent threats or leaves one the capacity to back out of his own threat, hence the incapacity to make the threat persuasive. The mutual defense agreement with the nationalist government of China is probably to be viewed partly as a means of shifting the decision for response to someone whose resolution would be less doubtful. And more recently, the proposal to put nuclear weapons in the hands of European governments has been explicitly argued on grounds that it would enhance deterrence by giving the visible power to retaliate to countries that might in certain contingencies be thought less irresolute than the United States. The use of thugs and sadists for the collection of extortion or the guarding of prisoners, or the conspicuous delegation of authority to a military commander of known motivation, exemplifies a common means of making credible a response pattern that the original source of decision might have been thought to shrink from, or to find profitless once the threat had failed. Just as it would be rational for a rational player to destroy his own rationality in certain game situations, either to deter a threat that might be made against him, and that would be premised on his rationality, or to make credible a threat that he could not otherwise commit himself to, it may also be rational for a player to select irrational partners or agents. In the matrix in Figure 14 in the supplement, disregarding the numbers in parentheses, if Rho has a second move, he loses in the lower right corner, column gaining his own preferred outcome. If a third party without power of decision is scheduled to receive as a byproduct the payoff in parentheses, Rho can win if some means is available for irreversibly surrendering his move to the third player. The payoffs of the latter are such that with second move, he wins in the upper left-hand corner, leaving the original row player. The payoffs of the latter are such that with second move had to be financed by row, whose own payoffs were correspondingly reduced. It would still be worth his while to make an irrevocable assignment of portions of his various payoffs to the third player, together with assignment of the decision. With the figure shown, he would still carry away a net value of 3 in the upper left-hand corner, in contrast to 1 in the lower right. Mediation. The role of mediator is another element for analysis in game theory. A mediator, whether imposed on the game by its original rules or adopted by the players to facilitate an efficient outcome, is probably best viewed as an element in the communication arrangements or as a third player with a payoff structure of his own who is given an influential role through his control over communication. But a mediator can do more than simply constrain communications, putting limits on the order of offers, counteroffers, and so forth, since he can invent contextual material of his own and make potent suggestions. That is, he can influence the other player's expectations on his own initiative in a manner that both parties cannot help mutually recognizing. When there is no apparent focal point for agreement, he can create one by his power to make a dramatic suggestion. The bystander who jumps into an intersection and begins to direct traffic at an impromptu traffic jam is conceded the power to discriminate among cars by being able to offer a sufficient increase in efficiency to benefit even the cars most discriminated against. His directions have only the power of suggestion, but coordination requires the common acceptance of some source of suggestion. Similarly, the participants of a square dance may all be thoroughly dissatisfied with the particular dances being called, but as long as the caller has the microphone, nobody can dance anything else. The white line down the center of the road is a mediator, and very likely it can err substantially toward one side or the other before the disadvantaged side finds advantage in denying its authority. The principle is beautifully illustrated by the daylight saving time controversy. A majority that wants to do everything an hour earlier just cannot organize to do it unless it gets legislative control of the clock. And when it does, a well-organized minority that opposed the change is usually quite unable to offset the change in clock time by any organized effort to change the nominal hour at which it gets up, eats, and does business. Mediators can also be a means by which rational players can put aside some of their rational faculties. A mediator can consummate certain communications while blocking off certain facilities for memory. In this regard, he serves a function that can be reproduced by a computing machine. He can, for example, compare two parties' offers to each other, declaring whether or not the offers are compatible without revealing the actual offers. He is a scanning device that can suppress part of the information put into it. He makes possible certain limited comparisons that are beyond the mental powers of the participants, since no player can persuasively commit himself to forget something. The problem of persuasively denying oneself the knowledge that one receives by the left hand while actively seeking it with the right hand is nicely illustrated by the efforts of parts of governments to obtain accurate data on incomes for the purpose of statistical programs, while another part of the government is seeking the same data in order to impose taxes or to prosecute evasion. Governments have found it important to seek ways of guaranteeing that the statistical agency will deny the information it receives to the taxing agency in order to receive the information in the first place. An analogous case of relying on an explicit mediator is that of companies that turn trade secrets over to a statistical bureau that is committed to destroy the individual data after computing the sums and averages that it will make public for the benefit of the contributing companies or of public opinion services that suppress potentially embarrassing individual data on political or sexual practices, publishing only the aggregates. The use of mediators to forestall identification seems to be a common tactic when a buyer of large resources thinks a painting or a right-of-way can be bought cheap if the owner is unaware who it is that is interested. Mediators may be converted into arbitrators by the irrevocable surrender of authority to him by the players. But arbitration agreements have to be made enforceable by the players deliberately incurring jeopardy, providing the referee with the power to punish or surrendering to him something complementary to their own value systems. In turn, they must be able to trust him or to extract an enforceable promise from him. But in any case, he increases the totality of means for enforcing promises. Two people who do not trust each other may find a third person that they both trust and let him hold the stakes. Communication and its destruction. Many interesting game tactics and game situations depend on the structure of communication, particularly asymmetries in communication and unilateral options to initiate communication or to destroy it. Threats are no good if they cannot be communicated to the persons for whom they are intended. Extortion requires a means of conveying the alternatives to the intended victim. Even the threat, "Stop crying or I'll give you something to cry about," is ineffectual if the child is already crying too loud to hear it. It sometimes appears that children know this. A witness cannot be intimidated into giving false testimony if he is in custody that prevents his getting instructions on what to say, even though he might infer the sanction of the threat itself. When the outcome depends on coordination, the timely destruction of communication may be a winning tactic. When a man and his wife are arguing by telephone over where to meet for dinner, the argument is won by the wife if she simply announces where she is going and hangs up. And the status quo is often preserved by a person who evades discussion of alternatives, even to the extent of simply turning off his hearing aid. As discussed in the earlier part of this chapter, mob action often depends on communication in a way that makes it possible for the authorities to obstruct mob action by forbidding groups of three or more to congregate. But mobs can themselves intimidate the authorities if they are able to identify them and to communicate with them. Even a tacit threat of subsequent ostracism or violence may be communicated from a riotous mob to the local police, if the police are known to them and are persons who have to reside among them when the occasion is over. In that case, the use of outsiders may forestall the mob's intimidating threats against the authorities, partly by reducing the subsequent occasion for carrying out the threat, but partly also through the difficulty of tacit communication between mob and police. Federal troops in Little Rock may have enjoyed some immunity to intimidation just by being outside the tacit communication structure of the local populace, and being patently less conversant with the local value system than were the local police. State troops were dramatically successful in quelling the Detroit race riot of 1943, when the local police were ineffectual. The use of Moors, Sikhs, and other foreign language troops against local uprising may owe some of its success to their poor capacity to receive the threats and promises that the enemies or victims might otherwise seek to convey. Even the isolation of officers from enlisted men in military service may tend to make officers less capable of receiving and perceiving threats, hence less capable of being effectively threatened, and thus deterring intimidating threats themselves. It is important, of course, whether or not the threatener knows that his threat cannot be received, for if he thinks it can, and it cannot, he may make the threat and fail in his objective, being obliged to carry out his threat to the subsequent disadvantage of both himself and the one threatened. So the soldiers in quelling the riot should not only be strangers and not only keep moving sufficiently to avoid acquaintance with particular portions of the mob, they should behave with an impassivity to demonstrate that no messages are getting through. They must catch no one's eye. They must not blush at the jeers. They must act as if they cannot tell one rioter from another, even if one has been making himself conspicuous. Figuratively, if not literally, they should wear masks. Even the uniform contributes to the suppression of identification, and so itself makes reciprocal communication difficult. Conveyance of evidence. Communication refers to more than the transmission of messages. To communicate a threat, one has to communicate the commitment that goes with it, and similarly with a promise. And to communicate a commitment requires more than communication of words. One has to communicate evidence that the commitment exists. This may mean that one can communicate a threat only if he can make the other person see something with his own eyes, or if he can find a device to authenticate certain allegations. One can send a signed check by mail, but one cannot demonstrate over the telephone that a check bears an authentic signature. One may show that he has a loaded gun, but not prove it by simply saying so. From a game theory point of view, the Paris pneumatique differs from an ordinary telegraph system, and television differs from radio. One role of a mediator may be to authenticate the statements that the players make to each other. For example, a code system for identification might make it possible for people to transmit funds orally by telephone, the recipient being assured by the bank's code response that it is in fact the bank at the other end of the line assuring him that the payer has been identified by code and that the transaction is complete. The importance and the difficulty of communicating evidence is exemplified by President Eisenhower's Open Skies proposal and other suggested devices for dealing with the instability that may be caused by the reciprocal fear of surprise attack. Leo Szilard has even pointed to the paradox that one might wish to confer immunity on foreign spies rather than subject them to prosecution, since they may be the only means by which the enemy can obtain persuasive evidence of the important truth that we are making no preparations for embarking on a surprise attack. It is interesting to observe that political democracy itself depends on a game structure in which the communication of evidence is impossible. What is the secret ballot but a device to rob the voter of his power to sell his vote? It is not alone the secrecy, but the mandatory secrecy that robs him of his power. He not only may vote in secret, but he must if the system is to work. He must be denied any means of proving which way he voted. And what he is robbed of is not just an asset that he might sell. He is stripped of his power to be intimidated. He is made impotent to meet the demands of blackmail. There may be no limit to violence that he can be threatened with if he is truly free to bargain away his vote, since the threatened violence is not carried out anyway if it is frightening enough to persuade him. But when the voter is powerless to prove that he complied with the threat, both he and those who would threaten him know that any punishment would be unrelated to the way he actually voted. And the threat, being useless, goes idle. An interesting case of tacit and asymmetrical communication is that of a motorist in a busy intersection who knows that a policeman is directing traffic. If the motorist sees, and evidently sees, the policeman's directions and ignores them, he is insubordinate, and the policeman has both an incentive and an obligation to give the man a ticket. If the motorist avoids looking at the policeman, cannot see the directions, and ignores the directions that he does not see, taking a right-of-way that he does not deserve, he may be considered only stupid by the policeman, who has little incentive and no obligation to give the man a ticket. Alternatively, if it is evident that the driver knew what the instructions were and disobeyed them, it is to the policeman's advantage not to have seen the driver. Otherwise, he is obliged, for the reputation of the Corps, to abandon his pressing business and hail the driver down to give him a ticket. Children are skilled at avoiding the receipt of a warning glance from a parent, knowing that if they perceive it, the parent is obliged to punish noncompliance. Adults are equally skilled at not requesting the permission they suspect would be denied. knowing that explicit denial is a sterner sanction, obliging the denying authorities to take cognizance of the transgression. The efficacy of the communication structure can depend on the kinds of rationality that are imputed to the players. This is illustrated by the game situation known as having a bear by the tail. The minimum requirement for an efficient outcome is that the bear be able to incur an enforceable promise, and that he be able to transmit credible evidence that he is committed either by a penalty incurred or by a maneuver that destroys his power not to comply, like extracting his own teeth and claws. But if the bear is of limited rationality, having a capacity for making rational and consistent choices among the alternatives that he perceives, but lacking the capacity to solve games, that is, lacking the capacity to determine introspectively the choices that a partner would make, the communication system must make it possible for him to receive a message from his partner. The partner must then formulate the proposition, choice, for the bear, and communicate it to him, in order that the bear may then respond by accepting the promise, now that he sees what the solution is, and transmitting authoritative evidence back to his own partner. Incorporation of moves in a game matrix. One is led to suppose that if a game has potential moves like threats, commitments, and promises that are susceptible of formal analysis, it must be possible to represent such moves in the traditional form of strategy choices, with the payoff matrix of the original game expanded to allow for the choices among these various moves. The first point to observe is that a commitment, a promise, or a threat can usually be characterized in a fashion equivalent to the following. To make one of these moves, a player selectively reduces, visibly and irreversibly, some of his own payoffs in the matrix. This is what the move amounts to. We could also say that one openly selects a strategy in advance for responding to the other's choice, but more than selection is required. The player must invoke penalty on his own failure to pursue subsequently the particular strategy of response that he has selected beforehand. And to invoke a penalty on failure to follow a strategy is mathematically equivalent to subtracting the amount of the penalty from one's own payoffs in all cells that do not correspond to the strategy so selected. Specifically, in Figure 15A in the supplement, Roe would commit himself to lowercase Roman numeral 2 by subtracting from his own payoffs in the first row sufficiently large quantities, 5 in the example shown, to make lowercase Roman numeral 2 a dominant strategy, that is, a strategy that he would follow no matter which column the other player selects. The result would be the modified matrix shown in Figure 15B, committing himself to lowercase Roman numeral 1 with penalty of 5 would yield the matrix in Figure 15C. Can we now build up a larger matrix that represents not only the actual choices of rows and columns in the original game, such as those in Figure 15A, but also the strategies of commit, threaten, promise, and so forth? Certainly, once we have specified what moves are available and the order in which they are to be taken. Take this simple game in which Roe has the power to commit himself visibly in advance, and Column has first move in the original game. That is, chooses his column before Roe makes his final choice of Roe. Originally, Roe, having second move, had 4 strategies available. He could pick lowercase Roman numeral 1 no matter what. He could pick lowercase Roman numeral 2 no matter what. He could play lowercase Roman numeral 1 to column uppercase Roman numeral 1 and lowercase Roman numeral 2 to column uppercase Roman numeral 2. Or he could play lowercase Roman numeral 2 to column uppercase Roman numeral 1 and lowercase Roman numeral 1 to column uppercase Roman numeral 2. Including the possibility of commitment, he now has first the choice of committing himself, And to each of these first choices, he can attach any one of the four strategies just mentioned for his final move. For example, he can commit himself to lowercase Roman numeral 2 and play lowercase Roman numeral 2 no matter what. He can commit himself to lowercase Roman numeral 2 and play lowercase Roman numeral 1 no matter what. He can commit himself to lowercase Roman numeral 2 and play lowercase Roman numeral 1 to column uppercase Roman numeral 1. Lowercase Roman numeral 2 to column uppercase Roman numeral 2. Or he can commit himself to lowercase Roman numeral 2 and play lowercase Roman numeral 2 to column uppercase Roman numeral 1. Lowercase Roman numeral 1 to column uppercase Roman numeral 2. Altogether, he has 12 possible strategy combinations. Column has 8 possible strategy combinations. For each of 3 contingencies, he has either of 2 moves. The moves being uppercase Roman numeral 1 and uppercase Roman numeral 2. The contingencies being Rho's commitment to lowercase Roman numeral 1, Rho's commitment to lowercase Roman numeral 2, and Rho's non-commitment. If we put these strategies into matrix form, we get figure 16 in the supplement. The 12x8 matrix of figure 16 represents the tacit, non-cooperative game that corresponds to the player's private decisions on how to play the original game. The 8 possible strategies available to Column, for example, can be thought of as the 8 possible distinct sets of complete instructions that he might give an agent who would then play the original game for him. That is, play the game at which he chooses one of 2 columns, depending on whether and how Rho committed himself first. There is no loss to either player in being supposed to play this enlarged game tacitly. Since what would have been each player's adaptations to the other's prior moves is now fully allowed for in the specification of strategies in the enlarged version of the game. They are strategies of response or adaptation. This is brought out in the labeling of Figure 16. As before, Column's choices in the original 2-move game are labeled uppercase Roman numeral 1 and uppercase Roman numeral 2. Rho's choices, lowercase Roman numeral 1 and lowercase Roman numeral 2. Additionally, the symbol 2 will denote Rho's commitment to Rho lowercase Roman numeral 2. 1, a commitment to Rho lowercase Roman numeral 1, and 0, a decision not to commit himself. In the enlarged game, a single strategy for Column is now denoted by 3 pairs of symbols, such as 0, Roman numeral 1, 1, Roman numeral 2, 2, Roman numeral 1, which would mean, choose Column Roman numeral 1 if he does not commit himself. Column Roman numeral 2 if he commits himself to row 1, and Column Roman numeral 1 if he commits himself to row 2. For Rho, a strategy consists of a decision on 0, 1, or 2, plus a pair of symbols denoting how he will react to each of Column's possible choices. For example, 1, uppercase Roman numeral 1, lowercase Roman numeral 1, uppercase Roman numeral 2, lowercase Roman numeral 1, would mean commit to Rho, lowercase Roman numeral 1. Then choose Rho lowercase Roman numeral 1 no matter what Column does. Knowing the payoffs in the original game, figure 15a, the players can identify the payoffs in the enlarged game of figure 16. We can imagine Rho and Column, instead of meeting to play the original game, sending their agents to play for them. Each agent fully instructed for all contingencies, that is, given one particular strategy for the enlarged game. To determine what instructions to give, Rho and Column consider the matrix in Figure 16. In effect, they play the tacit game in that matrix, leaving to their agents just the role of messenger. What is the solution of this enlarged tacit game? Or rather, can we identify an evident solution to the original game? And if so, how does it show up in the enlarged matrix? The original game clearly has a solution for rational players. A. If Rho is committed to Rho lowercase Roman numeral 1 with a penalty of 5 for breaking his commitment, Column can see that Rho lowercase Roman numeral 1 will be chosen no matter which column he chooses. Column chooses his preferred cell in the upper row, which is the upper left cell, lowercase Roman numeral 1, uppercase Roman numeral 1. And Rho knows that if he commits himself to Rho lowercase Roman numeral 1, he gets the payoff in that upper left cell, which is 2. B. If instead Rho commits himself to Rho lowercase Roman numeral 2, subtracts 5 from his payoff in Rho lowercase Roman numeral 1, Column chooses uppercase Roman numeral 2 in preference to uppercase Roman numeral 1, and Rho knows he will get 5. Finally, C. If Rho remains uncommitted, Column knows that Rho will pick the highest Rho payoff in the column chosen. Thus, if Column chooses uppercase Roman numeral 1, Rho takes lowercase Roman numeral 1, and Column gets 5. If Column takes uppercase Roman numeral 2, Rho takes lowercase Roman numeral 2, and Column gets 2. Column prefers uppercase Roman numeral 1. This leaves Rho a payoff of 2, and Rho can anticipate it. So, Rho's best outcome is to commit himself to Rho lowercase Roman numeral 2. This is the evident solution. It has a payoff of 5 and 2, and it corresponds to the strategy 2. Uppercase Roman numeral 1, lowercase Roman numeral 2, uppercase Roman numeral 2, lowercase Roman numeral 2 for Rho, and to all four strategies containing 2 uppercase Roman numeral 2 for Column. What Column would have done in contingencies 0 and 1 is of no material consequence once Rho has made his first move. These are the starred cells in figure 16, Rho lowercase Roman numeral 10. In effect, Rho's first move is a choice of which to play among the three different two-move games, A, B, and C, shown in figure 15 in which he has second move. How do we characterize the cells or pairs of strategies that represent the solution in figure 16? They constitute a solution of the kind that has been called a solution in the complete weak sense. It can be arrived at within the framework of the enlarged matrix by a process of discarding dominated rows and strategies. A row is dominated by another row if every payoff to row in the dominating row is at least as good as the corresponding payoff in the dominated row, and at least one payoff is better. Applying this criterion, the first row is dominated by the third, and we strike it out. The argument might be that Rho can safely eliminate the strategy represented in the first row, since the third is at least as good in every contingency and better in some. So is the second, so is the fourth, so are all the rest except the tenth. Neither the third nor the tenth row dominates the other, so for the moment we keep them both. Comparing columns, no single column dominates another. But having eliminated all rows but the third and tenth, arguing perhaps that Rho would not choose them anyway, Column can make his comparison between only the third and tenth cells in the columns. Now it is apparent that the second column dominates the first, the third, the fifth, and the seventh. After striking out those columns that are dominated in the reduced set of rows, we can look again at rows lowercase Roman numeral 3 and lowercase Roman numeral 10. Originally, neither dominated the other, but with the first, third, fifth, and seventh columns gone, the tenth row dominates the third. Striking out the third row, we are left with a single row, Rho lowercase Roman numeral 10, intersected by four columns. The payoffs are the same in the four intersections, indicating that it is inconsequential which of those four strategies column plays, as long as row plays the tenth row. That is, once row has committed himself to the second row of the original 2x2 matrix, figure 15A, as column can expect him to do, it makes no difference what instructions column gives his agent regarding the two contingencies that did not arise. This, then, is the way that a solution to the original sequential move game shows up in the static, moveless, or simultaneous tacit choice game. It is a solution arrived at by discarding dominated strategies, with the criterion for domination reflecting only the undiscarded strategies at each stage. This seems to be the general form of solution in the enlarged tacit game that corresponds to a sequential move game when the latter has a determinate solution. The discarding of rows and columns can actually be identified with the process of first calculating the rational last move for all possible sets of prior moves, then knowing what last move would follow each next-to-last move, calculating the best next-to-last move for all possible sets of prior moves, and so on back to the best first move of the game. While it is instructive and intellectually satisfying to see how such tactics as threats, commitments, and promises can be absorbed into an enlarged abstract super game, game in normal form, it should be emphasized that we cannot learn anything about those tactics by studying games that are already in normal form. The objects of our study, namely these tactics together with the communication and enforcement structures that they depend on, and the timing of moves have all disappeared by the time the game is in normal form. What we want is a theory that systematizes the study of the various universal ingredients that make up the move structure of games. Too abstract a model will miss them. The matrix representation of a sequential game does help emphasize, however, that the formal determinateness of games that are resolved by tactical moves does not detract from their essential game of strategy character. A threat wins and determines an outcome only because it induces the other player to choose in one's favor. The other player retains his original freedom of choice, and his choice still depends on his anticipation of the threatener's final choice. The threatener's first choice, to threaten or not, thus depends on what he expects the threatened player to expect the threatener to do. The reciprocal expectation character of the game remains. The threat, like the unconditional commitment or like the broader concept of reaction function when many choices of action are available, works by constraining another player's expectations through the manipulation of one's own incentives. The paradox of strategic advantage. It is, of course, a corollary principle that if the payoff matrix to begin with had already shown values for one of the players reduced in the same pattern as that in which he would reduce it deliberately at the winning move, he simply wins without needing to make the move overtly. This is the point that, in diagrammatic form, was illustrated in the final paragraph of Chapter 2, and referred to as an abstract example of the principle that, in bargaining, weakness may be strength. There is probably no single principle of game theory that epitomizes so strikingly the mixed motive game as this principle that a worsening of some or even all of the potential outcomes for a particular player and an improvement in none of them may be distinctly, even dramatically, advantageous for the player so disadvantaged. It explains why a sufficiently severe and certain penalty on the payment of blackmail can protect the potential victim, how the burning of bridges behind oneself while facing an enemy may dishearten an enemy and induce his retirement, or why a lady might, in an earlier era, defy the search party by haughtily placing the sought object in her bosom. It was reported unofficially during the Korean War that when the Treasury Department blocked communist Chinese financial assets, It also knowingly blocked some non-communist assets as a means of immunizing the owners against extortionate threats against their relatives still in China. Quite likely for owners located in the United States, the very penalties on transfer of funds to communist China enhanced their capacity to resist extortion. Deliberately putting one's own assets in a form that made evasion of the law more difficult, or lobbying for more severe penalties on illegal transfer of one's own funds, or even getting oneself temporarily identified as a communist sympathizer so that his funds would be blocked, might have been an indicated tactic for potential victims to discourage the extortionate threat in advance. A similar principle is reflected in Article 26 of the Japanese Peace Treaty, which gives the United States certain claims if subsequent Japanese territorial concessions to other powers are more favorable. When the Japanese were reported to be under pressure from the Russians for additional territorial concessions in 1956, Secretary of State John Foster Dulles pointedly described that article of the treaty in his press conference, and said that he had recently reminded the Japanese of the existence of that clause. The evident intention was to strengthen Japanese resistance, and it may be supposed that by reminding the Russians of the same clause through the medium of his press conference, Dulles helped to provide the Japanese with the familiar bargaining claim, "If I did it for you, I'd have to do it for everyone else." It was, in terms used earlier, a commitment secured by the penalty of a forfeit to the United States. Paradoxically, the United States could not give the Japanese the benefit of this bargaining gimmick unless the United States were patently motivated to take advantage of its claim if the tactic failed. Strategic moves. If the essence of a game strategy is the dependence of each person's proper choice of action on what he expects the other to do, it may be useful to define a strategic move as follows. A strategic move is one that influences the other person's choice in a manner favorable to oneself by affecting the other person's expectations on how oneself will behave. One constrains the partner's choice by constraining one's own behavior. The object is to set up for oneself and communicate persuasively to the other player a mode of behavior, including conditional responses to the other's behavior, that leaves the other a simple maximization problem whose solution for him is the optimum for oneself, and to destroy the other's ability to do the same. There is probably no contrast more striking in the comparison of the mixed motive and the pure conflict, zero-sum, game than the significance of having one's own strategy found out and appreciated by the opponent. Hardly anything captures the spirit of the zero-sum game quite so much as the importance of not being found out, and of employing a mode of decision that is proof against deductive anticipation by the other player. Hardly anything epitomizes strategic behavior in the mixed motive game so much as the advantage of being able to adopt a mode of behavior that the other party will take for granted. It can, of course, be an advantage in the zero-sum game to have the opponent believe firmly in a particular mode of play for oneself, but only if that belief is in error. In the mixed motive game, one is interested in conveying the truth about his own behavior, if indeed he has succeeded in constraining his own behavior along lines that, when anticipated, win. Another paradox of mixed-motive games is that genuine ignorance can be an advantage to a player if it is recognized and taken into account by an opponent. This paradox, which can arise either in the coordination problem or in the immunity from a threat, has no counterpart in zero-sum games. And similarly, in a zero-sum game between rational players with full information, it can never be an advantage to move first. To play the Minorant game in the language of von Neumann and Morgenstern. In the mixed game, it certainly can. Chapter 6. game theory and experimental research. The foregoing discussion suggests several conclusions about the methodology appropriate to a study of bargaining games. One is that the mathematical structure of the payoff function should not be permitted to dominate the analysis. A second one, somewhat more general, is that there is a danger in too much abstractness. We change the character of the game when we drastically alter the amount of contextual detail that it contains, or when we eliminate such complicating factors as the player's uncertainties about each other's value systems. It is often contextual detail that can guide the players to the discovery of a stable or at least mutually non-destructive outcome. In terms of an earlier example, the ability of Holmes and Moriarty to get off at the same station may depend on the presence of something in the problem other than its formal structure. It may be something on the train, or something in the station, something in their common background, or something that they hear over the loudspeaker when the train stops. And though it may be difficult to derive scientific generalizations about what it is that serves their need for coordination, we have to recognize that the kinds of things that determine the outcome are what a highly abstract analysis may treat as irrelevant detail. A third conclusion, which is particularly applicable whenever the facilities for communication are short of perfect, where there is inherent uncertainty about each other's value systems or choices of strategies, and especially when an outcome must be reached by a sequence of moves or maneuvers, is that some essential part of the study of mixed motive games is necessarily empirical. This is not to say just that it is an empirical question how people do actually perform in mixed motive games, especially games too complicated for intellectual mastery. It is a stronger statement that the principles relevant to successful play, the strategic principles, the propositions of a normative theory, cannot be derived by purely analytical means from a priori considerations. In a zero-sum game, the analyst is really dealing with only a single center of consciousness, a single source of decision. True, there are two players, each with his own consciousness. But Minimax strategy converts the situation into one involving two essentially unilateral decisions. No spark of recognition needs to jump between the two players. No meeting of minds is required. No hints have to be conveyed. No impressions, images, or understandings have to be compared. No social perception is involved. But in the mixed motive game, two or more centers of consciousness are dependent on each other in an essential way. Something has to be communicated. At least some spark of recognition must pass between the players. There is generally a necessity for some social activity, however rudimentary or tacit it may be, and both players are dependent to some degree on the success of their social perception and interaction. Even two completely isolated individuals who play with each other in absolute silence and without even knowing each other's identity must tacitly reach some meeting of minds. There is, consequently, no way that an analyst can reproduce the whole decision process either introspectively or by an axiomatic method. There is no way to build a model for the interaction of two or more decision units, with the behavior and expectations of those decision units being derived by purely formal deduction. An analyst can deduce the decisions of a single rational mind if he knows the criteria that govern the decisions. But he cannot infer by purely formal analysis what can pass between two centers of consciousness. It takes at least two people to test that. Two analysts can do it, but only by using themselves as subjects in an experiment. Taking a hint is fundamentally different from deciphering a formal communication or solving a mathematical problem. It involves discovering a message that has been planted within a context by someone who thinks he shares with the recipient certain impressions or associations. One cannot, without empirical evidence, deduce what understandings can be perceived in a non-zero-sum game of maneuver any more than one can prove by purely formal deduction that a particular joke is bound to be funny. To illustrate, consider the question whether two people looking at the same ink blot can identify the same picture or suggestion in it if each is trying and knows that the other is trying to concert on the same picture or suggestion. The answer to this question can be found only by trying. But if they can, they can do something that no purely formal game theory can take into account. They can do better than a purely deductive game theory would predict. And if they can do better, if they can rise above the limitations of a purely formal game theory, even a normative, prescriptive, strategic theory cannot be based on purely formal analysis. We cannot build either a descriptive theory